the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.
Well, good evening again. My name is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now. And tonight on Education Now, I'm going to share the AMS 2008 Fall Conference keynote address, Positive Discipline for Developing Capable Young People, by Dr. Jane Nelson. And I'm really excited to share it with all of you. So without further ado, let's get going. And she had sort of a false start with the mics, and so you can hear when we start that she's starting again. So here we go.
I want to start again with the quote by Maria Montessori, that any child who is self-sufficient, who can tie his shoes, dress or undress himself, reflects in his joy and sense of achievement the image of human dignity, which is derived from a sense of independence. And it's so interesting to me that, are you aware that none of you, but that your neighbors are still dressing your children in the morning? And it's so interesting to me that they don't realize that they are robbing their children of the opportunity to learn that I can be independent, I can be capable. And they do it in the name of love, because they think that they'll look better and because it's faster. And so in the name of expediency and looking good for the neighbors, they are robbing their children the opportunity of developing this kind of independence. And see, I think the greatest gift we could give our children is to help them develop the belief that I am capable and I can contribute in meaningful ways. And so I know that this is the whole purpose of the Montessori education and also of the positive discipline. Maria Montessori went on to really develop a wonderful curriculum, and Affenatter and Rudolf Dreikers, they focused mostly on behavior. So again, Maria Montessori said the child can only develop by means of experience in his environment. And I think that too many other educators try and just stuff it in, which I'll talk about a little bit more, instead of allowing the child to experience. So what do children need? Experiences to help them develop social and life skills. How? When you see every behavior challenge as an opportunity to teach life skills. Now, isn't that interesting that whenever you come across a child who's misbehaving, you can say, oh, isn't this exciting? I'm so glad this child is misbehaving, because now I have an opportunity to turn this into an experience where this child can learn some valuable social and life skills. And that's really true. So let's just talk about some of these, what it might be as strong-willed. Now, I always love that one, because when somebody tells me I have a strong-willed child, I always have to say, what do you want, a weak-willed child? No, what we want is a child who has a strong will, and then it's our responsibility to help guide them so that they can learn to use that will in useful ways. But fighting, it's like when you have children who are fighting, you teach them problem-solving skills. And when you have morning hassles and bedtime hassles, you teach them routines so that they can feel self-sufficient and capable by following the routines that they have helped create. Backtalk. You know, one of my favorite statements about that, when parents say my child backtalks, I say, well, don't backtalk back. Because this is what we usually do. Instead of teaching them what to do, we just say, don't talk to me that way, young lady. Instead of realizing what you might have done to be disrespectful in the first place, that it created the backtalk. And so that's one of the things we want to take a look at, is our responsibility in creating whatever is going on. Because have you ever thought about the fact, I'm sure you have, that a power struggle takes two? And when parents and teachers are always telling me what the child does, I always want to say, and what did you do? And not in a sense of blame, but in a sense of awareness. And that is why in the latest edition of Positive Discipline, which was the 25th anniversary edition, one of the main things I wanted to convey is that parents and teachers need to take more responsibility for what they do to help create the interactions that are going on, and to do that in an encouraging way, not in a sense of blame and shame. So I'm not going to go through all of these. I just think you get the idea that these are the lists that so many parents complain about and what we need to, oh, I do have to mention, don't listen, won't listen. Whenever a parent tells me that their child won't listen, I know that that parent is not listening to the child. It's like they haven't given them a model of what listening is all about. And because they're usually so busy lecturing that they haven't listened to the child. So we'll go on and talk, first of all, that positive discipline is never humiliating. There's no blame, shame, or pain, no punishment. And of course, when I say that, people often think, oh, what does that mean, that you're going to let children do whatever they want, that you're going to be permissive? Absolutely not, because that's not respectful of the child. As Mother Maria said, discipline must come through liberty. We do not consider an individual disciplined only when he has been rendered as artificially silent as a mute and as immovable as a paralytic. He is an individual annihilated, not disciplined. Don't you just love Maria? I mean, she knew the truth and she didn't mince words. And I really do think that so many parents and teachers do not really get how they annihilate children. So it is not permissive, because permissiveness teaches children that love means getting other people to take care of me, or that the world owes me a living. And so that is certainly not what we're talking about. That's not respectful to children. It's not respectful to adults. So I have come up with what I call the 5 criteria for positive discipline. First, it must be respectful, both kind and firm at the same time. Now, some of us don't feel like being kind when we're challenged by a certain child, but it's like, isn't it interesting how often we expect the child to control his or her behavior when we haven't controlled our own? And so sometimes we just need to take a deep breath and wait till we can get to that kind, be both kind and firm at the same time. Effective discipline helps children feel that sense of belonging and significance that is so important. It's the primary goal of all children. And as I will talk about later, when children don't feel that sense of belonging and significance, that is one of the main reasons why they may misbehave, as a mistaken way to try and find belonging and significance. And it is effective long-term. Now, it's so interesting to me that I will never tell you that punishment doesn't work, because it works. If all you're interested in is stopping the behavior right now, punishment can do that. But what is the long-range effect on the child as far as what that child is thinking and feeling and deciding about himself and what to do in the world? So 4, it teaches valuable social and life skills for good character. Now, have you ever thought of discipline as doing that? Well, that's to me what true discipline does. And the last one, it invites children to discover how capable they are and encourages the constructive use of their personal power and autonomy. Now, every tool that I'm going to be giving you, and I hope to give you a lot of tools, that's one thing I really like to share with people, is not only the philosophy, but what does it mean in practical application for what you do with children. But every tool that I will give you meets every one of these criteria, and you can see that punishment does not meet any of them. So let's go to tool 1, to be both kind and firm at the same time, because kind shows respect for the child, and firm shows respect for the needs of the situation. I love it, again, when I found a quote from Maria Montessori where she says, if we could say we are respectful and courteous in our dealing with children, we treat them as we should like to be treated ourselves. We should have mastered a great education principle and be setting an example of good education. So I love it when I find cartoons that really illustrate a point. And so here you have this adult and this child into this power struggle where the mom is saying no, and the little boy says yes, and she says no, and he says yes. And then the mom remembers to be both kind and firm, so she picks him up and gives him a hug and says no. And he says okay. And then later he's saying a hugging no isn't fair. Well, a hugging no may not be fair, but it can be very effective. I would like to talk about some others, and here it comes back to hugs, hugs, hugs. And part of this is that I have a new theme in positive discipline called connection before correction. I want to say that again because I just love it. I think it's so important. Connection before correction. And sometimes a hug will do that. And I want to share with you where I got this idea. I was watching a video with Bob Bradbury, who's an Adlerian in Seattle who used to do the Sanity Circus, where he would interview a child in front of a whole group, actually the parents. And this one parent, father, said, what do I do about my child, my four-year-old, who's always having these temper tantrums? And Dr. Bradbury said, well, why don't you just ask for a hug? Tell him you need a hug. And this father saying, are you kidding? Isn't that rewarding the misbehavior? And he said, I don't think so. Why don't you try it? So the next week, the father came back, and he reported that this is what had happened. His little four-year-old starts having this temper tantrum, and the father just gets down and says, I need a hug. And the little boy's going, what? And the father says, I need a hug. And the little boy's going, now? And the father says, yes, I need a hug. And the little boy goes, oh, all right. And he just slowly gives his father, stiffly gives his father a hug. And then pretty soon he relaxes, and they just melt into each other's arms. And the father says, thanks, I really needed that. And the little boy said, so did I. And often people say, why say you need a hug? Because if you talk to tell the child you need a hug, he doesn't feel like he needs a hug, but it gives them an opportunity to give and to contribute. And that was more appealing to this child than telling him he needed a hug. And I'd like to share with you an email that I got after sharing this at one conference. A lady wrote, my daughter Madison, who is a wonderfully strong-willed six-year-old, didn't want to get up and get ready for school one day. Being a strong-willed individual myself, now that gives you a clue, I could sense a battle of wills brewing, though I was determined to avoid it. I repeatedly asked her nicely to get up and get herself ready, and I picked out her clothes, another mistake, so she could move a little faster. Still, she refused to move. I reminded her still nicely that the bus would be at our house soon, and if she didn't get dressed, she was going to miss it. She sat up and looked at her clothes and screamed, I don't want to wear that. Her tone was so nasty that I found it hard to keep myself composed. But I went to her room and picked out two other outfits so she could choose which one she wanted to wear. And announced to her, I laid out three sets of clothes. You need to pick one and get dressed. I had almost made it to the bedroom exit when she fired back, I want four. I was so angry at that point that what came next surprised both of us. I walked over to her and said, Madison, I am going to pick you up, hold you, hug you, and love you. And when I am done, you are going to get up and choose an outfit and get dressed. When I picked her up and put my arms around her, I felt her just melt in my arms. Her attitude softened immediately, and so did mine. That moment was amazing to me. A volatile situation turned warm a few seconds just because I chose to hug a child who was so unhuggable. At the NEYC conference, you talked about the power of a hug to calm down an out-of-control child, and I learned firsthand that you were absolutely right. Thank you for teaching others about the power of a hug, Mary Wardlow. Later, Mary learned that it would be better for her child to pick out her own clothes to feel more self-sufficient, and it might lead to more cooperation. But I want to share another example. I received this from a preschool teacher who said, today a four-year-old boy stormed away from the art table screaming that he was mad, frustrated, and not happy. My assistant followed him over to our comfy cushion where he had wrapped himself in a blanket, now just screaming wordlessly and kicking the cushion. He refused to talk to the assistant, just continuing to scream. I sat next to him and whispered, I need a hug. He continued screaming and writing. After about 15 seconds, I repeated, I need a hug. He stopped screaming and flailing, but kept his back to me. 10 more seconds, I need a hug. Long pause, and he turned over, climbed into my lap, and hugged me. I asked him if he wanted to go back to the art table by himself or if he wanted me to go with him. He asked me to go with him. He went back, finished his project happily, and left the table. And I just think these are such beautiful examples of how sometimes a misbehaving child is a discouraged child, and what they just need is encouragement. Now, they may not be in the mood for it at that time, so sometimes I suggest to parents or teachers to say, I need a hug. Come find me when you're ready. And then walk away and let them have their feelings for a while until they may. But I love to start with this because of that theme of connection before correction, but there are many other ways to make a connection besides just a hug. And what I hope to point out is that as I speak with you, please hear principles, not techniques. Techniques, just kids can smell them and they usually don't work. So if you hear a principle, then you will take it into your heart and your wisdom, and you will apply it in a way that fits for you and the situation. And connection could be made in lots of different ways. But I want to give you another example of a mother who shared with me, and you could listen to her whole story. You know, I have podcasts on positivedisciplined.com, and so I interviewed this mother after she had taken a workshop because she was so excited about this connection before connection piece. And she told this story about her little 10-year-old who would always pee on the toilet seat because he didn't want to take the time to lift it up. And so she was the only female in the family, so she always got the benefit of the wet toilet seat. And so she said she had pleaded, scolded, bribed, tried everything she could, and just nothing worked. So after the workshop, she went home, and sure enough, there's pee on the toilet seat. And she says to him, "Kenny, you know, I love you so much, and I am going to love you every day for the rest of your life, even if you pee on the toilet every day for the rest of your life. And I would appreciate it so much if you wouldn't." And he hasn't sensed. So there's sometimes just really knowing to make that connection in whatever way, and sometimes it's just to validate their feelings or to listen or to put a hand on their shoulder, just supporting them. While, in fact, if ever you ignore a child, it's best to not ignore the child but ignore the behavior. And sometimes you can put a comforting hand on their shoulder, just letting them have in their feelings, letting them know you're there without engaging in the behavior. Just to say I care about you, to say I'm on your side, to ask for an appointment to talk about it later. And I'm sure you can think of many, many other ways to make that connection. So how many of you can agree with what I've been saying so far? Let me just see your hands. Have you ever noticed that sometimes it's just not easy? So let's talk about why it might not be so hard. Do you know that you all have buttons? And guess who knows what your buttons are and how to push them? And do you know what happens when your buttons get pushed? You go into your reptilian brain. And reptiles eat their young. So what we wanted to do for just a second is have a little bit of understanding about why punishment doesn't work. And for a minute, I would like you all to engage with me in a brain lesson, a lesson on the brain. So would you all hold your hand up like this? And your hand, the palm of your hand down to the wrist, represents the brain. And, I mean, the whole hand represents the brain, but from the palm of the hand to the wrist is the reptilian brain, the stem, the brain stem. And it regulates very important things like your breathing and your heart rate, those autonomic functions. Now, put your thumb into the palm of your hand, and this represents the midbrain. And the midbrain is where you store the fight-flight response, and also those old memories of I'm not good enough or fear, whatever the memories that go there. Then bring your fingers down over your thumb, and this represents the cortex. And the back of the cortex regulates all your senses. The front of the cortex is the only place where thinking takes place. And especially down here at the prefrontal cortex that touches all other parts of the brain, it regulates so much that I have a little list here. The regulation of emotions, of interpersonal relationships, the response flexibility, intuition, social cognition, self-awareness, letting go of fears, morality. And this is based on the work of Daniel Siegel, who has written a book called Parenting from the Inside Out, and who all did a lot of brain research. Now, you've got your brain here, and do you know what happens when your buttons get pushed? You flip your lid. Now, when you flip your lid, what have you got exposed here? Just that fight-flight response, those old memories of fear and inadequacy. And because of mirror neurons, suppose you have flipped your lid, what's your child going to do? Flip his or her lid. So what have you got? Midbrain to midbrain. And it could be the child that goes first, and then you react, and you go. So what you need to do at a time like this, this is not the time to try and solve a problem. And yet, when do most parents and teachers think they need to solve the problem? I've got to get them now, or else I'm letting them get away with something. And yet, if we really understand this, we need to do something to self-soothe, to calm down, until we engage the rational brain again. And that is the only time we can be really effective to teach something positive. And so I know that you all understand what is the most popular discipline method used today, except in Montessori schools? Timeout. Only it's usually the very punitive kind. You go to your timeout and you think about what you did, and I'll tell you when you can come out. Which is the silliest thing you can say is, do you think about what you did? Because what do you think children are going to be thinking about? What you did, not what they did. Or at worst, they may be thinking, gee, I really am a bad person. I can't do anything right. And that is not healthy at all. But I do advocate, besides the punitive timeout, which is grounding, jail in your room, naughty chair, that it is a great tool to teach children to self-soothe and that they do need to take time for calming down until they can engage the rational brain. And so I suggest that you create positive time out area with the children in your homes or in your schools. And what that might look like is it could be, but it's, you'll notice I'm saying with your child. That's the very important part. Ask them, what would help them feel better? Could it be a cozy corner that has books and tapes and music and anything that would help them calm down and feel better? So then you call it something else because it's hard to get over the connotation of the negative timeout. So some children have called it their cool-off place, their feel-good spot. My granddaughter decided to call hers Bob. And another one, Sparkles. And I used to think that this would only work in with preschool, elementary, not in a high school, but I was in a high school where they called theirs Hawaii. And they built a palm tree and did, I mean, they were very sophisticated. But it's important that they create it and that they name it. And in one preschool, they used a timeout grandma. And so that the kids could go sit on grandma's lap. I mean, the idea is it'd be really nurturing. That's one of my grandchildren, because I had somebody make this grandma. I used to haul her around with me anymore. I don't wonder what happened to her. But even positive time out is not appropriate for children, I think, under the age of 3 1/2, maybe even 4. And one of the clues is if children can't understand this, see, I think you teach this to your children. Wouldn't that be a great thing for them to understand? And I know that one teacher shared that after learning this, she came into the lounge, the teacher's lounge, and said, boy, I've had a lid flipping day today. But to understand that we do that. But I want to show, I mean, most of you have probably already seen the Piaget demonstration, but I hope you show this up to your parents, because most parents don't really understand child development and the brain and how it works. And I have found this one of the best ways to help teach them to understand this. And what Piaget taught is, and when I was teaching child development, I always asked a student to bring in a 3-year-old and then a 6-year-old. And with the 3-year-old, I would first ask them, now, do these glasses have the same amount of water? And they would agree that they did, or I'd pour back and forth until they did. I said, I want you to watch closely what I'm going to do. I'm going to pour this glass into this taller one, and I'm going to pour this glass of water into this shorter, fatter one. Now tell me, do they still have the same amount of water? And what will a 3-year-old say? No. Which one do they think has more? The tall one. Almost, I mean, they always do. But then you bring a 6-year-old, and the 6-year-old will say, yeah, they still have the same amount, or like one, no, because you spilled some, which I did. But I think it is so important to help parents understand this, that how can you even think about sending a child of 2 or 3 even to time out where they don't understand conservation, they don't understand the advanced ways of cause and effect. And so there's in there developing a sense of blame and shame, according to Erickson, instead of a sense of autonomy. And I think it's very important to help parents understand that. So then how do you use positive timeout? You say, would it help you? So the child is having a problem. You say, would it help you to go to your feel-good spot? And they might say, no. And you say, would you like me to go with you? And they still might say, no. So you say, okay, I think I'll go. And then you turn around and you go, because you're modeling for them that this is not a punitive thing. It can be a very good thing. Remembering again that there's never one tool that works all the time with every child. So modeling is so important. If you want to model what you teach, find your own timeout, which might be just to count to 10. Take deep breaths. Take a walk if you can. Let them know I'll get back to you when I feel better. Or let's put this problem on the family meeting agenda or the classroom meeting agenda, which also we will talk about a little bit later. Now, sometimes positive timeout is enough. And sometimes follow-up may be required. And so what you want to do is follow up with curiosity questions. But first I want to point out that what we need to do is stop telling. This is about one of the few times I'll tell you what not to do. I like to tell you what does work better than what not to do. But are you aware of how many parents and teachers sometimes, except for Montessori teachers, tell? They often have this finger going. They tell kids what happened. They tell them what caused it to happen. They tell them how they should feel about it, and they tell them what they should do about it. In fact, I want to show you what this looks like to the child. Can you all see that? You know, it's just, they all these things, talk, 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 and we just go, 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 and then we wonder why children learn to tune it out. It goes in one ear and out the other. And so we need to stop talking so much. And as Maria Montessori said, if education is always to be conceived along the same antiquated lines of a mere transmission of knowledge, talk, 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 there is little to be hoped from it in the bettering of man's future. So what we need to learn is to stop talking and learn to ask curiosity questions. Now, again, I hope that none of you write this down as a script. I mean, you could write it down to learn the principle, but it has to come from your heart and your wisdom in the situation to ask, you know, what happened? What do you think caused it to happen? How do you feel about it? What ideas do you have to take care of the problem? Actually, you can create a little peace table in the classroom where they might even have a form that each of them can go sit at the peace table and they each talk about their version of what happened, what caused it to happen, how they feel about it, what ideas they have to solve the problem. And this is another theme of positive discipline, is focus on solutions. Instead of punishment or even logical consequences, which I'm going to say right now, and I may have time to get to in more detail, but I used to talk a lot about logical consequences. And what I have learned over the years, as I keep talking to parents, and they keep trying to disguise punishment and call it a logical consequence. So many years ago, I came up with the three R's of logical consequences that means to be related, respectful, and reasonable. Still, I kept hearing examples that sounded like punishment to me, or people would think it's the only tool. What would be the logical consequence for this? Do you know how many schools there are out there that all they talk about is consequences? And they're not consequences, they're punishment. And so finally, I was in a school with third graders in Virginia, and they were doing a class meeting, and they were talking about the logical consequence for a child who had been late from recess. And they were coming up, everything they said was punishment. So I just said, time out, time out. What would happen if instead of a logical consequence, you just focused on a solution that would help the child not be late next time? Well, they got it right away. So we continued around the circle, and every suggestion they came up with was helpful. And then the child got to choose the one that he or she thought would help him. It was a little boy in this case, what would help him the most. So I think that if we learn to ask, the root of education comes from educare, which means to draw forth. And isn't this the whole purpose in the curriculum of Montessori? We draw forth from the child rather than trying to stuff in. As Maria said, he who is served is limited in his independence. Oh, wait a minute, forgot something. Okay, I want to give you another example. Instead of going through the long, well, what happened, what do you think caused it to happen, I thought there are sometimes we need to just learn how to use a sentence that's much more simple. So I've asked for some volunteers who I would like to come up, and what they're going to do is I have the three volunteers, would they come up? What we have is I'm going to have an asking parent or teacher. Come up here, Hannah, so everybody can see you. Come on, up, up, up. Okay, so see, you're the asking parent, right? And you're the telling parent, and here's our little child. Claudia is now, 5 or 6 years old? Okay. So what she's going to do is first she's going to go and hear the telling parent tell her something, and then she's going to walk over and hear something from the asking parent, and then back and forth a few times so you can get an idea. And what you want to be watching at, if you were the child, what would you be thinking, feeling, and deciding as you heard each of these comments? So go. Oh, wait a minute. Here. We want to make sure we hear what you say. And you're just going to react by what you're thinking, feeling, or deciding, okay?
Go brush your teeth. Go brush your teeth. Got to get going. Go brush your teeth.
What do you need to do so your teeth won't feel scuzzy?
Okay, back over here.
Don't forget your coat. Come on, don't forget your coat. We gotta go. Don't forget your coat.
What do you need to take so you won't feel cold?
Mm-hmm. I am cold.
That's because you forgot to take your coat.
Hey, it's late. Get to bed. Come on, get to bed. Go. Go. Get to bed.
What do you need to do to get ready for bed?
Okay, it's time. Let's get the homework done. Do your homework. Come on. Come on, do it.
What is your plan for doing your homework?
You don't have one, do you?
I told him to skip that one because we're in a Montessori group, but...
7, 8, and 9.
That's okay. Just go down to number 7, 8, 9.
Okay. Hurry up and get dressed. You're going to miss the bus. Come on, we got to hurry. Come on.
What do you need to do so you won't miss the bus?
Mm-hmm. Oh, for goodness sake, stop whining. Just stop. We have to hurry.
What words can you use so that I can hear you?
Okay, I think we can stop. Now, wait a minute. So stay here for just a second. I think you get the idea. But what I would like to ask now is, Claudia, as a child, what are you thinking, feeling, and deciding when you go to the telling parent?
Well, it brought me right back to my childhood. My mother told. And for me, it hurt. And I didn't rebel. I just withdrew. Yeah.
And so how did you feel, and what were you thinking, feeling, and deciding when you're over here?
Well, I like that, actually. It's what I have now in my life, but it was foreign, as feeling as a child. That was a foreign language, what I was hearing. It was really nice. It was much better.
But did you notice how she brightened up? And what happens when you go over here is it invites the child to think and the child to have some power, which invites them to cooperate and to feel competent and capable. So let's give them a hand. Thank you. So again, you know, what I often tell parents and teachers is not to try doing any curiosity questions for about a week. Just go home and set up a jar, and every time you tell, put a dollar in the jar. And in a week, you will probably be able to go to Hawaii. And so what you do is you just think about, well, what could I have done? How could I have put that in the form of a question that would have drawn forth from the child? Now, again, not the only not the only tool every time. So now, when Maria said, he who is served is limited in his independence, Dreiker said, never do anything for a child that a child can do for himself. But then when I found out that Maria also said that, and I'm not sure who said it first, but anyway, they both had that idea that we really take away from a child when we do things for them. And one of the ways that really helps, and I know you have routines in the Montessori school that help children feel safe, but one way to avoid bedtime hassles and morning hassles is to create routine charts with, again, that word, with children. And it can be, it could really help avoid so many problems. And here is an example of a routine chart that I created with my granddaughter. And what we did first is we sat down at the table and I said, well, Kara, what do you need to do before you go to bed at night? Unless she made the list. And then I took pictures of her doing each thing. And, of course, her chart didn't look like this. It was vertical. But then, so cute, because she said, well, Grandma, the last thing I do is I sleep, so you got to take a picture of me sleeping. Now, can you see how much more inviting it is to a child? And I hope you share this with all your parents, because it is such a valuable tool that the routine chart becomes the boss. Instead of you telling, you can say, well, what's next on your routine chart? Or they will tell you, because they feel so excited when they have created it. With older children, they may not want the pictures of themselves, but they might like to just make a list of what they need to do and get symbols from the computer or draw their own pictures. You can do a lot of different ways, but still, it's very empowering to the child and teaches them some time management and to have control over their routine. So now, another thing that's very important to understand is the belief behind the behavior. There is always a belief behind every behavior. And sometimes we just deal with the behavior, and that makes as much sense as if you had an arsonist who was setting fires all over town and you kept putting out the fires, but you never did try to catch the arsonist. And so we really do need to understand the belief behind the behavior, because children are always making decisions about who they are. Am I good? Am I bad? Am I capable? Am I not capable? They're making decisions about the people, the adults, especially in their life. Are they safe, threatening or friendly and unfriendly? And then what do I need to do to survive or to thrive based on these decisions? Now, I want to show you sometimes where those beliefs start. Here's this little cartoon that shows the mommy saying, "Use mommy, little boy. Yes, you is. I just love you to pieces. Yes, I do. Kissy, kissy, kissy." And the oldest one is sitting there watching. And what happens as soon as the mom's away? It's like, whop. How many of you are oldest children? Let me see your hands if you're an oldest child. Do you remember the day that you were dethroned when that child, other child was born? It often creates that belief. I want to show you a song, play you a little song about this.
Oh, it's hard to be number one, and lately it's just no fun at all. Life was so nice when we were three, Mommy and Daddy and me. When I was the only one, everyone noticed me. They said, what a cute little baby, what a handsome child he'll be. And now there's another, and I don't like it one bit. Send it back to the hospital, and let's just forget about it.
So I want to tell you a little story that illustrates what might be going on in the mind of a child when a new child is born by telling you the story called The Tale of the Second Mother by Ed and Barbara Jano. And this story goes like this. Once there was a very happy family, and the father was this really good father. He was hardworking and generous and loving, and the mom was a great mom. She was loving and helpful and encouraging, and the child was this good little perfect child, and one day they looked at each other and said, look at us, we're so happy, why don't we have another? So the next day, the father and the child went down to the mother's store and brought home a brand new mother. Now, imagine you are the first mother. How do you want that second mother to be? Do you want her to be as wonderful as you are? Do you want your children to love her as much as they love you? And your husband. Now, come on, be honest. How do you want her to be? dumb, ugly, bossy, bitchy, irritating, stupid, helpless, lazy, and suffering from a fatal disease. Now, I want to share with you what one mother did, because she understood how important it was to deal with the belief behind the behavior. She had a little four-year-old who was feeling very dethroned by the birth of a new baby. So she waited until the baby was asleep. She sat down at the kitchen table with her little girl, and she said, "Honey, I want to tell you a story about our family." And she got some candles out of the junk drawer. She said, "Now, these candles represent our family. And this is the mommy candle. This is the one for me." And she lit that candle and said, "And this flame represents my love. And when I married your daddy, I gave him all my love. And I still have all my love left. And when you were born, this is the candle for you, I gave you all my love. And daddy still has all my love. And I still have all my love left. And when the baby was born, this is the candle for the baby, I gave the baby all my love. And you still have all my love. And daddy still has all my love. And I still have all my love left. And now look at all the bright light we have in our family with all this love." And isn't that just a beautiful way of dealing with the child's belief and not just the behavior? And one mother shared with me that she went home and did this with her 9-year-old, who was still feeling dethroned by the birth of a little brother, the first little brother. And even with her 9-year-old, she did this, and she said, she finally got it, and she just gave me a big hug, and I knew that she understood. So it is, can be very important to deal with the child's belief and not just the behavior, because misbehavior is based on a child's mistaken interpretation of how to find belonging and significance. A misbehaving child is a discouraged child. And if we could just remember that, because they don't look discouraged and they don't act discouraged sometimes when they're misbehaving. But someone just sent me this picture that shows the iceberg, and this is the behavior. But look what is underneath the behavior. That is that feeling of belonging and significance or lack thereof. And it's so much bigger and it's so much more as important to deal with. And also, this came from Visalia School District, where they're starting to do a lot of positive discipline. And when I saw this beautiful picture that shows the railroad track with significance and belonging and academic achievement, and that they're equally important, and if you don't have them both, you just have a lot. Well, the train won't go very far, if at all. So we really need to consider the... And the four mistaken goals of misbehavior are, first, when a child seeks undue attention. If I only have your undue attention, then I'll belong. Or the child who is into misguided power. If I only have used my power in misguided ways, or if I don't do what you want, or if I at least define the boss, then I'll belong. Or revenge is the child who doesn't feel he or she belongs, but at least I can get even. And then assumed inadequacy, this is the child who has given up. I can't belong, so I give up. And I want to play two songs that really illustrate the sense. Marie Hartwell Walker and Wayne Friedman were so good at capturing the feelings that a child might be having.
I believe that I belong when everyone notices me. I feel good when people gather round to look at me. Sometimes I am funny, sometimes I'm a pain, but all the while I sit and smile when the teacher calls my name. Oh, I can tap my pencil, scrape my chair, drop my books, comb my hair, whistle and hum, act real cute, make funny faces, yell and hoot, ask for a drink of water 10 times, sharpen my pencil, start to cry, wear my jacket inside out, one has to hang it up, I pout, go to the bathroom every hour, use flashcards to build a tower. Oh, I believe that I belong when everyone notices me.
Okay, now. that, just a little bit from Misguided Power.
No, honey, won't. You can't make me. I'd rather hold my breath till I turn blue than to do what you want me to do. Well, I don't think it's fair. When you boss me around, I might get and scream. Yes, I'll make a big sound and I'll stomp my feet, or I'll push and shove. I might sit there doing nothing at all, 'cause I don't have to. You can't make me. You can take away my bicycle too, with the banana seat and high-rise handlebars, but I'm not gonna listen to you. No, I won't. You can't make me. I'd rather hold my breath till I turn blue than to do what you want me to do. Well, I'm the...
Okay. These songs can both be funny and really tug at our hearts, because when children get into these, they aren't consciously aware. They couldn't tell you, I need undue attention, or I'm in misguided power. But when we learn to recognize it, and I will tell you, if anybody wants the mistaken goal chart, they're in all the books, but I also have them as a free download if you go to janenelson.com. You have to be sure and spell it N-E-L-S-E-N, and there are several other free downloads there. But to have the understanding of when the child is misbehaving and what to do about that to encourage them so that they feel that belonging and significance and don't need to find these mistaken ways. And I have these hats that really represent the main message of what the child needs. And I've got them up there while I show, because I know all of you can't read it. But this is the hat for undue attention. And this, what it says is, notice me, involve me usefully. And see, there's nothing wrong with attention. It's just whether they're doing undue attention or attention that is more useful and contributing. So this is the child that you would give something useful to do to get attention. And for I love this two-billed hat, because the main message is, let me help. Give me choices. And it's just so, if you're in a power struggle, if you will just stop and notice that and say, I can't make you and I really need your help, and find a way to get that child to use that usefully, have their power usefully. And this one is, I'm hurting, validate my feelings. And it's so useful. If you're feeling hurt, the child is probably hurt. And you may not know. It could have been something you did unknowingly. It could have been something that happened with another child. It could have been something at home. But as soon as you notice it, just say, looks like you're feeling hurt. Do you want to talk about it? But just that validating their feelings can often just stop that. And then the reason this one has the hat that is the camouflage hat is this child is often saying, I just give up, leave me alone, I want to disappear. But it says, the hat message says, don't give up on me, show me a small step. And it's like, it's very important to know what these goals are, because the same behavior can be for any one of the goals, but you would behave, react differently and encourage in different ways depending on what it is. So a child needs encouragement like a plant needs water. And that's why this connection before correction, it's like you encourage and then you can reach that child. And as Carter Baton said in a Life magazine, 1991, when he was asked to work with 13 students who had, at the second grade, had already been determined that they couldn't make it in a regular classroom. And as I read that article, I just thought, oh my gosh, he really gets what Dreikers and Adler and Montessori were talking about. And he said, you have to reach the heart before you can reach the head. And also, it's like Jim Tunney, who did his doctorate degree at USC, did perceptions of caring, and that quite often children don't believe the parent or teacher really cares unless they get good grades or unless they do what they're supposed to do. So we need to show students that you care, smile at them, have faith in them, greet them at the door, allow mistakes, apologize for your own mistakes, focus on solutions, acknowledge effort, show your personal self, give and expect respect, and ask for their help and offer to help. Now, it's interesting. This is the last thing I'm going to talk about because my time's almost up. But as I said earlier, So many people had learned both from Dreikers and from me about logical consequences, but now I would just say no more logical consequences, at least hardly ever. There are some times when a consequence might be appropriate because it's totally related to the, like I have this formula that says privilege, responsibility, and if you don't want the responsibility, you may need to leave the privilege. But I just think there's usually so many, if you focus on solutions, it's so much more effective. But here is the point. It's like imposing consequences on children is designed to make them pay for what they have done. On the other hand, when you ask curiosity questions, you're helping children explore the consequences of their choices to help them learn to find solutions. So another way to focus on solutions is let children help create a solution wheel, a wheel of choice. And like this is a fifth grade class in Illinois where they came up with things like ignore it, walk away, put it on the class meeting agenda, talk it out, use an iMessage, apologize, take a stop. But you see, the kids came up with all these ideas of what they could do when they were having an altercation with a child, and then they get to go and choose. So I do want to just very quickly introduce class meetings because I think it is so valuable. And this cartoon says, we put our chairs in a circle and started talking, and the next thing I knew, I learned something. And, you know, because of time, I just need to tell you that I think that class meetings can be very effective even in the preschool. And in our Positivism for Preschoolers book, which was co-authored by a Montessori teacher who used to have class meetings with the children, and she would put the 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds together. And so one of the examples she gives is how the kids were solving a problem about throwing wood chips on the playground. And the 4-year-olds and the 5-year-olds had great suggestions, and it would come to a 3-year-old who would say, I had bananas on my cereal this morning. And they'd say, oh, thank you for sharing. And so even though their thinking skills haven't come in, they're still experiencing it, so that by the time their brain development does change, they're already, because they've had that. And it's just, children feel so much belonging and significance and so capable when they are helping solve the problems. And I'm just going to go really to, I want the last. I love this quote by Toni Morris. Do your eyes light up when they walk into the room? And what more could help children feel that belonging and that significance and feel capable and be ready to feel that connection if your eyes light up when they walk into the room? Thank you very much.
Well, there you have it, the address by Dr. Jane Nelson, and I hope that their eyes light up for all of you when you walk into the room with a child. And I want to thank you all for listening. Dr. Jane Nelson's contact information is www.positivedisciplinealoneword.com. That's www.positivedisciplinealoneword.com and focusing on solutions. That's www.focusingonsolutions, contact information for Dr. Jane Nelson. The AMS, American Montessori Society, at www.amshq.org. LIS Education Now broadcasts in their monthly newsletter and on their website events calendar. For an unedited copy of this address, contact IGAMI, EGAMI, space A/V, at area code 817-2564. And I may have gotten that wrong, and so if you would please contact me at hermes@pacific.net if you would like an unedited copy of this address.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past
is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know.